Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and today we're going to talk about getting a diagnosis. Getting a diagnosis is very challenging these days, not only because we sometimes have anomalous symptoms, symptoms that could mean a number of diseases, like I have headaches, I have stomach cramps, I have fatigue, those kinds of things the doctor will look at and say, well, it could be any of 50 different things, or it could be that this person making them up. So sometimes just getting a fair hearing for your symptoms is in itself a challenge. And today we also have the challenge of medical tests. When they say you do have a disease, that's great. It helps to confirm a diagnosis. But those tests are not infallible. And in fact, there is room for error in most of those tests. So we're going to talk about false negatives. We're going to talk about the role of instinct in the medical profession and the very important role of having a good relationship with your doctor before you get sick. Our guest today is Tara Kittle, who actually has a diagnosis now of Lyme disease, but it took her a very long time to get there. So we'll be right back in a moment to speak with Tara Kittle. The Powerful Patient is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. We work with people who are dealing with complex medical conditions or who may be struggling to get a diagnosis. We help you learn how to manage your health, form a partnership with your healthcare providers, and manage your healthcare team. Read about us on our website at powerfulpatient.org. We welcome your questions either by email or telephone at 1-800-767-4845, extension 6. That's powerfulpatient.org. I'd like you to meet Tara Kittle. Tara is from Los Angeles. She's a young movie director. And Tara, could you please tell us something about what happened with your health?
Basically what happened was I got very sick in the fall of 2005. I was going along with life, making my first feature film that I was writing and directing. Everything was going great. And then all of a sudden I started to develop strange health problems. I started losing my hair, fatigue, weight loss, just like a lot of very unusual things. But because I was busy and in love with what I was doing, I didn't take time to stop and see a doctor right away. And I kept going and going, thinking it would just kind of go away. So by the time that I finally did stop to see physicians, I was already actually very sick. And that's when I started on my journey where I started to really learn the degree to which how malfunctioning our medical system is.
In what way?
It's malfunctioning both in regards to patients being able to actually access the medical care that they need and also in regards to physicians who want to give medical care to the patients who come to them. Unfortunately, both sides are having tremendous amount of difficulties being able to accomplish what they need to accomplish.
So tell us your story and how this sort of illustrates the point that you derived from it.
Well, basically, I was becoming sicker and sicker, and I stumbled upon the fact that antibiotics were making me feel better. And I really didn't know why, and I didn't understand exactly what they were doing, but I had gotten a prescription for PO antibiotics because I had a cough that wouldn't go away, and I also had a twitch on the right side of my face that wouldn't go away. They were both, by this point I could barely stand, I was sleeping all the time, I had pain all over, and the physician was like, you know, that's not normal. My blood work, of course, kept coming back negative, so he wrote me a prescription for I can't even remember now, an antibiotic, but it was working.
So when you say your blood work came back negative, so what were they testing you for?
At this point, they were doing, you know, obviously all the basics, sort of like the chem panel, CBC, and things like that. But then they were also, I was being tested for random diseases, like HIV came back negative, and then also Lyme disease kept coming up. And physicians because I'd been in Michigan making a film and I'd been bit by a tick. Mm-hmm. Physicians were like, oh, well, sounds like you could have Lyme disease, but those tests kept coming back negative. So basically at this point, no one had any kind of diagnostic testing and that was giving them any idea on how to proceed. But clinically, I kept having symptoms that were getting worse over time. And then when I started the PO antibiotics, it was sort of felt like putting a little bit of water on a blazing fire. Like they were helping, and they were definitely alleviating my symptoms, but it was like a crash and burn effect. I mean, it would make me feel a little bit better, but then a couple hours afterwards, I would start to feel a lot worse. It was like a pretty dramatic, actually, up and down.
So what are PO antibiotics?
Oh, oral.
Oral. Okay.
So I was kind of, you know, I was going through that process, and I realized that I needed an antibiotic drip because I needed antibiotics that were stronger and that could get into my system sort of more effectively. And again, I really didn't know why, but I had stumbled upon that people have antibiotic, you know, IV therapy when they really need it. So I was like,
Have they checked you for infectious diseases or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my workup, as I went along, kept getting more and more and more extensive. And there's some physicians, actually, at Cedars who joke that I've had one of the most extensive workups in the history of the hospital, just in terms of the number of tests I've had. I mean, lists of tests. I've been tested at this point now for, I don't want to say everything, because I'm sure there's some infectious disease that I haven't, but it's been something along those lines. And they all kept coming back negative. So here I was, basically, though, for me, not knowing anything about medicine, just being a sick woman who's making her first feature film that was about, I don't know, $500,000, who had at times 300 people working for me. I just wanted to get back to work.
Right.
I really didn't care about medicine or doctors or the medical industry or anything. I just wanted to get back to doing what I love to do. So I really didn't care. I was just like, I want this drip. So I didn't really then understand why it was so difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Like why physicians, a lot even ran out of the room. I was even kicked out of doctor's offices. I was just like, what's the big deal? Basically, what's the problem? What's the big deal? And then, of course, as I got worse, crash and burn, and I spent about 4.5 weeks in and out of hospitals. I could barely stand. When I mean I could barely stand, I would walk from my bedroom into the kitchen, and then I would have to sit down.
Did they do any testing for inflammation?
Yes. Yes.
And that came back what?
I can't remember now.
Okay.
During the fall of 05, but I know my SED rate was elevated for a long time, and as I did antibiotic therapy, it subsided. But I'm not 100% sure if my SED rate was elevated just because of everything I was going through, or if it was elevated because I'd had the rabies series, and I don't know if that elevated it. I can't remember.
Why did you have the rabies series?
Because I had had bat exposure when I was in Michigan.
Uh-huh.
So
there was a bat that bit you or came in contact with you in some way?
There was a bat actually in the room where I was sleeping that a friend of mine found and got out the window. And he had walked in the room while I was sleeping and found it. And again, something that you don't really know until you read about it. Bats can bite you when you're sleeping and you won't wake up and you won't know.
Wow.
And bats, of course, being one of, if not the most common way that people get rabies. So, and the tragedy is that you don't wake up, that you can be bit in your sleep. And I was making a film, I also happened to be very drunk that night, so I was intoxicated on top of it. So the very likelihood I could have been bit. And
as a preventive, they did the rabies series of shots.
Yes.
Because there's no cure for rabies. You have to either prevent it or you get it and you die. So, right.
And the exposure, the bad exposure had been about 8 or 9 months before that, but you can be exposed to rabies or bit, and it can take sometimes even a few years to actually develop into full-blown disease. Most people are most familiar with, there's two different types of rabies, and more people are more familiar with the furious rabies, which is the rabies that you get bit and then you're dramatically ill and die, a few weeks later. Mm-hmm. But there's also another kind called paralytic that is slow growing and can take time. So I was being vaccinated just in the off chance that I had that. But right. No one really thought that I did. I really didn't think that I did either, but it was just a precaution.
Sure. But there may be some fallout from having that series of shots?
There might have. I mean, who knows? There might have been. I don't remember if that elevated SED rate was from the triggered from the vaccine or mm-hmm. if it was from everything I had going on. But
your observation was that the antibiotics were helping. Whatever they were doing, it seemed to be making an impact.
Yes, and it wasn't just my observation. I had a twitch on the right side of my face that could not go away. I mean, I could not control it. It was a muscle twitch that was beyond control. I actually have this twitch on tape, so I can actually, you know, show people what it was like. And then
right.
that twitch went away with antibiotic therapy is what got rid of it.
Interesting.
So in addition to all my other symptoms, but unfortunately, with symptoms, a lot of them being what we can feel and not what other people can see, it becomes too easy for people to say, well, did she really feel it, or did she make believe that she felt it? The placebo effect, of course, is alive and well, and many people do get better on the placebo effect. It's a proven fact, but for everyone who gets better on the placebo effect, there's 8 people who get better because the drugs are actually helping.
Right, so the placebo effect is you take the drug and you think it's going to help you, therefore you feel better, even though it didn't really do anything.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically that you got better, and you think it was the drug, but actually there was no drug. You know, it was just, you were just getting better, and you associated
right.
with the drug. And the power of the mind, I do believe, is really important
mm-hmm.
and is instrumental with medicine. Yet at the same time, as I always love to say, I know a lot of depressed and bitter people who are perfectly healthy.
Right.
I mean, there's definitely an interplay.
Yeah. So, my goodness, this is quite an adventure you're having here. And so at this point, they've been testing you for everything, and you're trying to get IV antibiotics
yeah.
to see if that will impact it, and you're having a hard time getting that. So
yes.
did
yeah.
you finally succeed in getting the IV antibiotics?
Thankfully, yes. Otherwise, I wouldn't be alive talking with you. I did, and what it came down to was I was very grateful to stumble upon physicians who listened, physicians who were willing to embrace the part of medicine that we don't have absolute answers for,
mm-hmm.
that we don't have an automatic 1, 2, 3, 4, in a sense, laid out. They were like angels from heaven. And as I got better, I made a vow to myself to basically get to the root of why was it so scary. Why did it take finding these rare physicians who were willing to, in a sense, risk their livelihoods, their license to help me? It shouldn't have been that
right.
difficult.
Because there is a prejudice, of course, against giving antibiotics unless there's really clear evidence, and you didn't have clear evidence. But you did have a valid conjecture here that the antibiotics were going to help because you had the observation that, in fact, you had been helped to some extent by the antibiotics you were taking.
Well, yes, but that's actually also, though, right there, I think, captures what's wrong with our medical industry. It's what we actually consider to be evidence.
Right.
Right now, what we call evidence is test results. That's what we take to be fact. Well, that's the patient's evidence. Really, what we need to start thinking about evidence is actually the patient. Is taking the patient and the patient's clinical story as being the evidence. And then the test results and things like that as being guiding tools, which I think are extremely
right.
important. But ultimately, the patient should be considered and seen as being the best evidence that we have. But unfortunately, it's not that way right now.
Right. I think that's a valid point. But help us understand how you got there. I think you told me before that you didn't have the classic reaction to whatever it was that was going on. What was the underlying disease process that they were able to identify, or did they?
In my case, because I had confirmed tick bite,
yeah.
which was on my neck, which is one of the worst places to be bit, that I definitely had some kind of infectious disease process going on, and ultimately it was attributed to being Lyme disease.
Mm.
So which is a disease that we could have a five-hour show on in terms of how poorly it's understood. There's currently a lot of medical debate going on right now. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people who say they have Lyme disease, but they don't, mm-hmm. making things even more complicated for people who do need a lot of medical care. It attracts people who know they're sick, but they don't really know what they have, so mm-hmm. then they think they have Lyme disease. Yet at the same time, there are a lot of people who really are suffering horribly, who have false negative tests, who need long-term antibiotic therapy, who are having a hard time getting it. So it's a disease right. that I think really helps in some ways isolate all of what's working about our medical industry and what's not.
Let's take a little break here, and we'll be back to speak more with Tara Kittle about false negative tests and getting the right listening from your doctors to really achieve a diagnosis. Stay with us now, and we'll be right back.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
So you got the IV antibiotics and you got better?
Yes, very slowly over time.
Slowly, over what period of time?
Months.
Months. Wow. And the IV antibiotics actually did help because there was some infectious process going on, and yet the blood tests that they normally do for infection were coming up negative.
That's correct.
So as you say, these test results, the way we've come to rely on in the system, can sometimes lie to us.
Absolutely.
And there needs to be some flexibility in there for understanding that that might be the case.
Absolutely. Physicians need more legal control, and they need better legal support in order to make decisions on behalf of their patients. Our system is basically malfunctioning because we're not letting our physicians be physicians.
It used to be in the, 50 and more years ago that physicians had to rely on instinct. They didn't have the data collection or the data analysis processes that we have today. They would really rely on experience and instinct in a way that doctors really don't these days.
Yeah. I know, and unfortunately that they've been forced out of it. I mean, doctors today have actually been put in a catch-22. I mean, here they are being forced to make decisions based on test results that they know have, some of them, 20-40% false negative rate, which means if you're going to practice medicine based off test results, then you know you're sending yourself off to allowing 20-40% of the population, the sick population, to suffer unnecessarily. And as a physician, you've taken an oath to do no harm.
So let's go back over that for other people who are listening that may not understand what you really said there. So if you test 100 people and you have a 30% false negative rate, that means that 30% or 30 of those 100 people who in fact are sick mm-hmm. are going to test as though they're not sick.
Yes.
And are going to be essentially blamed for complaining about something that the tests are saying doesn't exist, but we know that that test is fallible and that it makes mistakes.
Yeah. And then they're going to be denied access to treatment, usually by their insurance companies, and so on and so on. Like people, like for example, I went to the Infectious Disease Society of America conference last fall, mm-hmm. which was invaluable, and I really enjoyed going to all the sessions and learning everything I learned. And in the MRSA session, a physician actually said on the microphone in the audience that echocardiograms have a 20% false negative rate even when the person has clinical, they've got bacterial endocarditis, which is an infection in your heart. An echocardiogram, of course, you know, is the ultrasound that they use to see your heart. 20% of people with an infection in their heart are going to have a false negative. I mean, it's just like...
So the test will say you're fine when in fact you're not fine.
Yes. You have an infection in your heart. I mean, it doesn't get... I mean, that's pretty serious.
That's a very serious thing, yeah. I mean, like, tomorrow you could keel over from this.
Yes. So, again, that's why we have to be able to support our physicians in terms of being able to make decisions. Now, related to that, of course, is the legal system, which is why doctors more and more and more are holding on to these test results because, yes, even though they know 20% of people are going to have false negative, you know, echocardiograms, they've got kids at home, medical malpractice, secretaries to feed, student loans to pay off, do they want to take a risk and order an antibiotic drip for somebody that's really sick with a negative echocardiogram and negative blood work, and then next thing you know they could be in a medical malpractice court because the person had an adverse reaction to the antibiotic. They had a rare, you know, allergic reaction and now they're dead. I mean, it's just a situation now where I think medicine has to go back to basics and we need to create a culture where patients and their loved ones take responsibility for medical actions.
Right. So in some senses, because there are now so many more diseases known, it's impossible for every doctor to know all there is to know about every disease. So
exactly.
We do need a good bit of technological support in making that information available.
Yes.
But at the same time, we also need room to say, wait a minute, this just doesn't feel right.
Yes.
And have some instinctual component here that's understood to be valuable.
Exactly.
Both on the part of the patient and on the part of the doctor.
Exactly. And I really think, like, when you're not obviously in the ER, which is, you know, when you're in a state of emergency, but when you're sitting with your physician in the office, you're of sound mind, and you say, look, I understand this can hurt me. I understand this has, you know, potential negative consequences, but I want to try it. The other thing, too, people need to be more forgiving of their physicians.
Yes.
It's really hard to be a doctor. There are a lot of diseases out there. There are diseases out there we don't even have names for, let alone the testing and the false negative results. It might take trying a few different things before you find something that works. It's not that doctors are stupid or uneducated, that they don't get the diagnosis right the first time.
You know, in business, there's a saying that if you're not making a certain number of mistakes, you're not trying hard enough.
Yeah.
And I remember Thomas Edison said, you know, he'd tried 1,000 different ways to make a light bulb before he finally found the right one.
Yeah.
And each time, you know, instead of looking at it as a failure, he looked at it, well, I've learned how not to make a light bulb. So in most contexts, we understand that making mistakes is normal and understood to be part of the process. But when it comes to medicine, somehow we expect our doctors to be perfect. And perfect is not a human quality.
Yeah. And you know why, though, of course? It's because the stakes are higher.
Right.
It's
exactly.
The human body. That's
right.
Where it gets, you know, more difficult. But
and we don't want people to just experiment randomly on our bodies. But as you say, when you and your doctor are in agreement that we are at an impasse here, we don't know what to do, we're going to have to try something that we don't know if it's going to work or not. But if you're willing and the doctor thinks that this has a chance of success, then why is there anybody else standing in the way of this twosome making what the two of you feel is the right decision to make?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Amen. Absolutely.
And the things that are standing in the way are sometimes the hospital with its own fears of the repercussions of the legal system, or the payer, the insurance company, is saying, wait a minute, Anna, there's not enough basis for doing this MRI or doing this experimental, what they consider an experimental therapy, which may in fact have a good bit of statistical validity behind it. It just hasn't had the clinical trial yet.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I always say, they are more than welcome to come talk to me. ex insurance company, you're more than welcome to come wherever you are, sit in the office, and let's have a talk. But the whole concept that they can direct the course of medical care, and saying no, by the way, is directing the course of medical care.
Yes.
The fact that they can even conceive that they can do that, to me, just exemplifies how malfunctioning our medical system is.
Right, that the bureaucrats can overrule the doctors who went to medical school and have looked at your records and have sat with you all this time, and then they can just say no.
You know how fast a physician would be thrown in to court for medical malpractice if they made orders for a patient that they didn't see in their office and didn't give an examination for?
Right.
I mean, the next day, if something went wrong, they would be in the courtroom. So then why is it that somebody sitting in an ivory tower doesn't share the same consequence? It just doesn't. I think that what happened is the loophole that got created that just kind of has been going on for a long time that somebody now just needs to close. That it's just time to sort of take a step back, take a breath, think logically about it, and then close it. So that's what I'm trying to do, is I'm trying to campaign and get organized to actually change the laws, because that's really fundamentally where the root of all of this is malfunctioning.
Right. One of the things that I've seen happen quite often is that when you're trying to find an early stage cancer, sometimes one of the best tools is to do a scan. And these scans are kind of pricey, okay? Yeah. It's, say, $1,000 to do an MRI or a CT. But it may be the only way to find an early stage cancer and get it out of you before it metastasizes. Removing an early stage cancer is usually fairly straightforward surgery.
Yeah.
But dealing with metastatic cancer is a last-ditch effort that's extremely expensive and a high risk.
Yeah.
And the person may not survive the experience.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't we want to find an early stage cancer? And yet for people who are at risk for cancers, who know that they may be getting them, sometimes it's really hard to argue to get that scan because the insurance company is saying, yes, but we don't want to spend the money this quarter.
Yeah.
And that's not a medical reason to not do a scan.
And they're also hurting themselves. I mean, that's actually a good example
right.
of how actually the insurance companies are hurting themselves. I had something similar with my gallbladder where I kept having, again, negative imaging studies, negative blood work, but my physician thought it was my gallbladder. And I agreed that it was my gallbladder, but I kept having negative studies, and I kept seeing more doctors and having more studies. And a year and a half later, I still had negative studies, negative blood work, negative imaging tests, and I begged the surgeon to take it out. I mean, I literally got on my hands and knees and begged him, and he didn't want to. He was like, why should I take out your gallbladder when I have stacks of negative tests? And I said, because it's hurting me. I really didn't know what else to say. Well, sure enough, they get in there, they cut me open, and I have chronic cholestasis.
Ooh.
Yeah, which is a very painful inflammation of my gallbladder. And again, I don't even want to think how many thousands of dollars my insurance company paid on all of those imaging studies and all of those doctor's visits for something that my physician and I, in January 2006, had agreed, both of us agreed, that it was my gallbladder and it needed to come out. And instead, it took till April 2007 to find a surgeon to take it out. And even then, the decision was still clinically based because all of my paperwork was negative.
Wow.
So
in your particular body, you just don't generate the same kinds of responses that they are measuring.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Let's take a little break here, and we'll be back to speak more with Tara about the difficulties of these false negatives. False positives are also a problem, but the bottom line is tests are not always right. And so while the test should be a good guidance tool, they are not the be-all and end-all of medicine. And we need to trust ourselves and our physicians to add a little instinct in here and at least talk about that and see if that can help lead us to a better conclusion. Stay with us now. We'll be right back to speak more with Tara. please go to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You will find there the handout that goes with this show, with information about the people we've spoken with, the websites we've mentioned, and other interesting background on the topic. And as always, we will certainly appreciate your support. Please donate to the Cancer Research Fund and bring us back another day. We have a challenge grant right now from the Dana-Farber-Harvard Cancer Institute. We're going to be putting together a jointly funded grant for a career development grant for a young researcher, and we certainly would appreciate your assistance in making that a reality. Stay with us now, and we'll be right back.
So in some percentage of people, those tests are just going to be very misleading or downright wrong.
Yes. I mean, my case is like about as scary as you can get right now in our current medical system, the way things are, because it's become to the point where they need those test results in some ways to protect them. So then what do you do with a patient that has shown, I mean, I've proven, documented, I've got all the paperwork to back me up, and they don't make a response. It's too frightening. But then they're really sick. It's not like in some ways it'd be easier if I was faking it, because then there would actually nothing would ever be wrong. But the
right.
fact that I have documented, you know, things wrong, like for example, I had bacteremia, cultured bacteremia, negative blood work, looked fine, no fever, no sweating. I told the doctor I was dying. I mean, I sat in his office and I was like, I didn't know why, and I was like, something's killing me. And he smiled, a very, very sweet man. And he just smiled at me and he said, sweetie, you know, you should probably just go home and take a nap and drink some fluids. And I was like, but I'm dying. I mean, I just, when you're sick and you don't have the education that a doctor has, sometimes we don't have the vocabulary to go much beyond, it hurts me.
Right.
Which is another reason why physicians need more control over how to direct our medical care, because sometimes patients might say, you know what, that feels right to me. Let's do a CAT scan because it feels right. I think I need one. Because we don't know exactly how to articulate ourselves in other ways. So,
right.
so I went home, and sure enough, a couple hours later, my blood cultures had been pulled 2 days earlier, and a couple hours later, I got a call, and they came back positive, and I had to go into the hospital. And I'm surprised I didn't give, actually, that doctor a heart attack, because he was just like, I've never seen that before.
Yeah.
You looked healthy. It's like, you look like the epitome of health.
Right.
And then you had, you know, and then my blood cultures came back positive. So.
But now this is classic. I mean, it happens to everybody, and it happens both to men and to women.
Exactly.
But it happens statistically more often to women.
Yes.
Because the doctor will, as you say, look at you and say, well, you look perfectly healthy. Well,
yeah.
Excuse me, but I'm not healthy. And the doctor is the one who went to medical school and has all the data and the technical knowledge.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you live with your body 24 hours a day, and the doctor is spending 15 minutes with you once in your lifetime. So,
yeah.
So, I mean, there has to be some room for your opinion in addition to the doctor's opinion and some negotiation process.
Absolutely.
That would arrive at the right answer. What's your experience with how to generate that kind of partnership with your doctor in a constructive way and get to a solution together?
Well, the key actually is in preventative. It begins when you're healthy. It begins by establishing a relationship with a physician when there's nothing going wrong. So they get used to you. They know you. You come in once a year. I tell my friends to think of it like doing their taxes. You go in. Everything's fine. They take your blood work. They do your blood pressure. Then you go home.
So you develop some credibility as a rational human being that speaks with authority about your health.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they just know little things. Like, they just know your personality. They know how you talk. They know how you stand. I mean, all of that information adds up when you're evaluating somebody who's sick. If they don't know you when you're healthy, then when you walk in sick, they don't know, well, are you normally a little anxious?
Right. I heard a story just the other night. Governor Deval Patrick in Massachusetts was speaking to a group of people about some of the benefits that are emerging from expanding health insurance in Massachusetts. And he said there was one woman who had been to the emergency room multiple times because she had no insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So she'd wait until she was really, really sick, and then she'd go to the emergency room. And she had this chronic, very bad sore throat. And they would has her off with, you know, some sort of palliative medication and send her home. Well, finally, now she has insurance. Now she has a general practitioner, and she goes to them for health care, not just for sick care. And they finally diagnosed that she has throat cancer.
Oh.
And now she's getting treated for throat cancer. But, I mean, this has been going on for years. And what a missed opportunity. If it could have been caught in an earlier stage, it would have been less difficult now to stop this train.
Absolutely, absolutely. And also, it's just sad, too, like why something that, if it, again, had also been caught early,
yeah,
would also have been not only more life-saving, but also would have saved financially a lot more money, too.
Absolutely. It makes business sense to catch things early. I think one... I get a chance to see the complex medical condition that I deal with, von Hippel-Lindau disease. I get to see it through the eyes of many different countries and medical cultures. And one of the differences that I've noted between countries that have health care for all and countries that don't, of which are ours is one of two, by the way, you know, us and Turkey don't have health care for all. Anyway, in a country where they've taken responsibility for your long-term health, they take a very different view. Here we look at fix this tumor and be sure to preserve this quarter's bottom line. But in Europe, they say, okay, how can we keep this person healthy in the workforce and paying taxes for his whole life?
Yep.
Okay, I can sign up for that. And so they take the longer view, and it's not about should we do this MRI this quarter. It's how early can we find this tumor, because that's when it's most easily fixed with less long-term damage, and that means this person's going to stay healthier longer.
And who knows, and then that person who lived might in turn maybe might one day save your life.
Exactly.
Either by, you know, you fell out of a tree and broke your leg and they were there to help you. I mean, you never know. All these things, all this energy goes out into the universe and comes back to us.
Right.
And I think we have something invested in taking care of one another. That's actually why I decided to start my nonprofit. It actually went back to a moment where I was really sick in the ER, and I also kept going to the ER because I was very ill. And I met a young man who was 18 years old who was there because his father was sick. And we got talking, and he told me the story about his uncle, who he loved very dearly. He saw him like a second father. He used to go over his house all the time. Well, he got diagnosed with stomach cancer a couple of years ago, and he didn't have health insurance, and he didn't make enough money to be able to afford the high-risk insurance, but he made too much money to qualify for Medi-Cal. So he died in his house a year and a half later of stomach cancer that had been actually caught early enough, where with treatment, he might have even still been alive to that day. I promised myself, I made a promise between myself and God, that if I lived through that fall, I was going to do whatever I could to help change the system in any way that I could.
That's great. Well, what's the name of your nonprofit? Tell us about this.
I'm calling it the Blue Diamond Foundation. And the idea behind it is that I believe every human life is rare and unique like a diamond. And blue, I associate, with the color of water, which is the foundation for life. So the Blue Diamond Foundation, it's going to be mostly a medical advocacy organization to try to actually solve and get to the root and change these problems. These solutions obviously aren't easy, and it's going to take, I think, pulling together some of the best minds in the country, but it's time to do it. Laws are like blueprints of a house, and currently we have a toilet in the front seat. That's the way I see it. So we need to get in there, and we need to ask ourselves as a civilization, how do we want to live, how do we want to treat one another, how do we want to be treated, and then we need our laws to reflect those principles.
You know, you talked earlier about the legal system and the fact that this is such a litigious society that it forces people to think, oh, you know, what are the legal ramifications of what I'm saying? And it's gotten to the point where if a person in a hospital makes a mistake, they won't even apologize, because the apology means that they're admitting they did something wrong and they could be sued.
Yeah.
So we've lost the sort of human interaction around apology and the room for making legitimate mistakes and fixing them rather than covering them up and just making the situation worse.
What to me all that is actually it's a sign of how our laws are actually failing.
Yeah.
It's not that most people think, oh, well, if it's very litigious, it's, we have too much law. Well, it's actually the reverse. We don't have enough law. Because people actually go into the courtroom when they need to work things out that aren't already sort of worked out ahead of time.
Yes.
So we need to actually work things out ahead of time. And right now, the physicians are being falsely persecuted for the most part. I've been a patient, and I've obviously been horribly, horribly, horribly treated by some physicians, and I'm a big believer in accountability. Like, I believe people should be held accountable for what they do, but what's going on right now is we're holding physicians accountable for the wrong things.
Mm-hmm.
Again, back to there's a lot of diseases we don't have names for, tests for, et cetera. Well, we can't really punish the physician for trying, and that's exactly
right.
What we're doing right now. We're doing
right.
A lot of punishing physicians who are actually earnestly trying to save your life. What's more dangerous and, to me, what's more appalling are the physicians who turn their back on you, who say, well, you know what, I'm not going to help you,
right.
Because that actually causes just as much harm, if not more harm, than actually trying and then failing. But right now, the doctor who turns their back on you, they don't get punished for that. You know, they don't go into court for that. It's the doctors
right.
who are trying, who do take medical action for you, are the ones in the courtroom. So it's like we need to basically, and I'm not blaming unfairly the doctors who turn their back, because I had a lot, turn their back on my case. It's scary. My case was really scary. I mean,
and it makes you more desperate too.
Yeah.
So it's going to drive more negative behaviors on the part of the patient in a certain sense, more desperate action on the part of the patient.
Yeah.
I think one of the other ramifications that we don't think of in launching lawsuits and so forth against doctors, there's a condition right now that's caused by overuse of gadolinium in MRI machines. It's a contrast medium that's used to highlight certain structures when they do the imaging. And certain brands of gadolinium can accumulate in the body, so that people who don't pee out as much fluid as they should, who may have compromised kidney function, are at greater risk for developing this complication. In any event, there's been some attempt to try to figure out how to fix this.
Mm-hmm.
And I was speaking with one of the radiologists the other day, and he said, actually, what's happening is that the lawyers are making it impossible for us to study this. And the reason for that is that they're out recruiting. There are ads on television now for, have you had an MRI lately? Do you have any of these symptoms? So the lawyers are trying to pull together class action suits and things like that. When this was done in all innocence, I mean, nobody intended to do anything wrong. Nobody made a blunder or did anything wrong at all. It's the long-term cumulative effect, something we never anticipated that we need to learn about. And yet, because of the legal actions that are being launched, hospitals and doctors are clamming up.
Yep.
And they will not share the data. You practically have to get a court order to get the data, which researchers, of course, are not going to do. And so the researchers can't get enough information to really solve the problem.
Yeah, exactly. And another thing that's clamming up physicians, too, are the HIPAA laws,
mm-hmm.
which on one hand, obviously, I believe that patients have the right to privacy and things like that, but that's how they learn, is discussing cases. Sometimes you see a patient for a moment and then you don't see them again because they move on, they go to some other physician, but you want to know, hey, what happened with that case? The person presented with this and this and this. And right now, if they're not your patient anymore, by law, you're not allowed to access the records. So we're cutting our physicians off from a very valuable and instrumental part of the journey of being a doctor, which is to learn. So I think the HIPAA laws should be changed to say, yes, obviously you shouldn't be discussing patient cases with the public, but I think those conversations held within medical circles amongst medical professionals should be allowed and even encouraged to thrive.
We need more collaboration amongst doctors, especially across specialties, because people are so compartmentalized these days. And also with the patients, more interaction with the patient in question to get the opinions from the patient as well as from the various physicians.
Yep.
I'm a great believer in team thinking. You know, the more diverse the team, the better the solution you generally come up with. And you don't even realize that that might happen until you try it a few times. So if you've never tried it, don't scoff it. It really does work.
Amen. And I actually have a big joke that I want every doctor at Cedars-Sinai to be thinking about my case.
Go ahead.
I'm always telling my doctors that. I'm like, I want everybody here thinking about what's wrong with me.
Right. Because the more they think about it, the more likely they are to come up with it.
Absolutely. The better minds, I mean, the luckier I am. I mean, I want them to be at parties, having drinks, talking about what's going wrong with me, you know?
Yeah. Some of the best thinking happens at cocktail parties.
We'll be back in just a moment to speak some more with Tara about Lyme disease and the difficulties of diagnosing it after this message from Keith Richards.
This is Keith Richards, a.k.a. Just Saying. Is there cancer in your family? There is in mine. But it doesn't have to be bad. We can take action to protect ourselves. I've learned how to get screened and manage my health so that I'll live a long, healthy life. How about you? Visit www.powerfulpatient.org. Again, that's www.powerfulpatient.org. Peace.
We're speaking with Tara Kittle about her journey to diagnosis of Lyme disease.
Well, Lyme disease is one of those diseases that's really very hard to diagnose. It's very hard to get even to the point of getting tested for it because it's those anomalous symptoms before that tend to get written off as female complaints or whatever.
Yeah.
So tell us, if there's someone out there who has Lyme disease or who thinks they may have, what's the best path to getting a diagnosis or getting it ruled out?
What you want to do is you want to find an LLMD.
And what's an LLMD?
A Lyme literate physician. And they will help you go through the process of analyzing your symptoms and help you make a clinical diagnosis. What you want is a clinical diagnosis. You don't want to rely on test results. Do the test results, definitely they can be guiding posts. But until those test results have gotten to a point where their accuracy is 100%, then you want to work with the physician who's basically willing to work with you. Otherwise, the disease is going to get to a point where could get to a point of no return.
Right. So if you don't get a fairly timely diagnosis, then the treatment is much more difficult and much more iffy as to whether or not it can neutralize the disease, right?
And expensive. I mean, I'm talking like thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars.
Right.
What could be, you know, a couple months at the most or even less if you catch it early. The other thing you want to do is if you get bit by a tick, the FDA issued a warning. It was in Newsweek magazine of May 2006 where they're now recommending if you get bit by a tick that you do 3 weeks of oral doxycycline. Now, that recommendation, you know, changes, and some people say no, which is, I think, in the New England Journal of Medicine article I was referring to, they recommended, I think, one single dose. But in May 2006 of Newsweek magazine, there was a warning by the FDA that said do 3 weeks. There's a reason for that. Even if you don't have a rash, even if you don't have any symptoms, if you have a tick bite in your skin, you want to do 3 weeks of oral doxycycline, because you don't want to get what I had.
So this is similar in many ways to what you were saying about rabies. I mean, it's a very nasty disease to have. If there's any possibility that you might have been exposed to it, you need to do the preventive.
Yeah.
And similarly with Lyme disease, it's much easier to prevent it than to diagnose and cure it.
Yes, absolutely. And yes, you know, there are obviously, we talked about, there's always possibility of harm from antibiotic therapy. But the harm that can be caused by not doing the preventative work and then developing the disease as severely as what some people get it, that kind of harm can be life-threatening. So preventative work is absolutely key.
Right, and it certainly destroys your energy level for very protracted periods of time.
Oh, people lose everything. I mean, my movie is still sitting in a computer, needing to be edited, and I still have a couple scenes left to shoot. I mean, people have lost their lives. Some people have died from this.
So this significantly interrupted your life for over a year?
Oh, Oh, it's still, I'm still on antibiotic therapy, 2.5 years later.
2.5 years mm-hmm. later.
And I'm still struggling.
Wow.
And this is not a conversation I have with a lot of people,
right.
because I've been through so many difficulties. It's insulting for me to feel like I need to justify myself to anyone. So I've become a little almost like obstinate, you know,
sure.
in terms of like, I just, when I, and like I tell my doctors and, you know, we talk about it, especially because my case is so difficult. I'm just like, you don't need to justify my case to anybody.
So when you said find a Lyme literate MD, how does one locate one of these?
Well, you can look online, you know, on the internet. You can join, there's some really good, like, Lyme groups and things like that. One good website to go to is LymeDisease.org. It's a website that's been put up by the California Lyme Disease mm-hmm. Association, and it has a lot of information. It educates people regarding both standards of care. I mean, right now there are sort of two standards of care regarding Lyme disease. It educates people on both, on all points of view, the dangers of long-term antibiotic therapy, the benefits. That's another thing, too, that gets thrown out a lot is people talk about the dangers of long-term antibiotic therapy, and it's like, of course there's dangers to long-term antibiotic therapy. I don't think anybody's denying that. There's potential dangers with any medication or any, you know,
right.
medical procedure. It's just the question is, do the dangers outweigh the benefits? And that
exactly. We always have to do a risk-benefit analysis for anything, including,
absolutely.
You know, a tooth extraction. You know, it's going to hurt, yes, but keeping
yeah.
that tooth is also going to hurt. So,
absolutely.
You know, how long would you like this to go on? So there's always a risk.
And I think, and honestly, until science has figured it all out, the answer to that question, risk-benefit, is made with the patient and the physician.
It has to be. The patient has to be involved in making the decision.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think if a doctor comes in and says, tomorrow we're operating, it, you know, this is the way it's going to be, then if anything goes wrong in that, that's the patient that will sue. But if the doctor
yeah.
comes in and says, yeah. okay, here's what it looks like, here's what we're dealing with, these are the possible options, my recommendation is that we operate and we should do it tomorrow.
Yeah.
And if the patient buys into that, even knowing what those risks are, that patient is very unlikely to sue even if things go south.
Yeah.
Because they've bought into it. They know that. They go in understanding the risks.
Yes, yes, yes. And frankly, most at this point in the game, most people are grateful
yes.
to have doctors who are willing to listen.
Yeah.
I mean, most of us are trying to get, a lot of people are trying to get medical care or access to medical care when, for whatever reason, financial, whatever, they can't. And I feel like doctors should be rewarded and appraised for taking medical action on behalf of their patients.
Right. And we
yeah.
need to generate the right kind of partnership where the patient understands the value in the physician's experience and expertise. And the physician also respects the contribution of the patient.
Yeah. People need to take more responsibility for their health and their bodies. Because another thing that's happening is sometimes the patient who signs off or agrees, but then does sometimes go back and later sue the doctor. Or that's what the physicians are at least afraid of.
Yeah.
And what we need to have is some kind of, just even like a little form to fill out, where the patient says, look, I'm of sound mind, and I understand X, Y, and Z, and they sign off on it. I'm a big believer in second opinions.
Yes.
Get a second opinion. If you're not sure or you have doubts, get a second opinion. A good physician will support you getting a second opinion. They will say, absolutely, go and hear somebody else's point of view. I think for anything invasive like surgery, I think a second opinion should be mandated when the action is sort of outside of the current standards of care. I think the patient should have at least one more second opinion because that would also help make sure to keep in check sort of like unnecessary and abusive surgeries and things like that.
Right, and it's certainly something that the patient can elect, I mean, given that there's time to do it. But certainly for anything that you're feeling the least bit queasy about, getting that second opinion will help you work through your own concerns about it because it's important to go into a surgery feeling confident. You need to really believe in what you've signed up for.
Yep.
Otherwise, it's going to be a longer recovery.
Yep. Yes, absolutely. And I'm a big believer tech too. Like I have to actually have, it looks like I have to have a little surgery. And I told my physicians, because they found a growth, and I told them, I said, you know what? I need 1 month of trying everything that I can to get this growth under control myself before I do the surgery. Mm-hmm. So I've been exercising, you know, every day of the week, eating right. I'm doing whey protein right now. I'm doing flaxseed every day. I'm basically trying to boost up my immune system enough to see if there's any way I can get this under growth under control myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I can't, then I'm going to do the surgery. But I think sometimes, too, you know, patients need to, we need to take a look at ourselves and be honest with ourselves. What are we doing in our lives that might be actually aiding and abetting these bad things happening?
Right.
See what I mean?
Right.
And look, we all can improve. I mean, we can all do things that definitely, I think, could be better, but especially when you have a situation where you've got some kind of confirmed disease process going on, you need to step up. And you need to look in the mirror and you need to ask yourself, do I want to live or do I want to die? And if the answer is I want to live, then your behavior needs to manifest that belief.
Right. So if you have emphysema, continuing to smoke is not a great idea.
Yes.
Right.
I mean, at a certain point, it's like, here's the gun. You know? I mean, you know?
Right.
Now, I'm a big believer in compassion, and I, especially in regards to smokers, I don't like what's happening right now with sort of like, oh, well, just because, you know, you're a smoker, then you don't deserve
it. It becomes a blame thing.
Yeah. And
but,
I don't
But on the
that.
Other hand, you do need to take a look at, you know, what's the long-term risk-benefit of smoking, and hopefully you make the right decision for yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And look, I mean, I say we got one life to live, and if you want to smoke and drink and do drugs every day, as long as you're not hurting anybody else, you know, okay, but then don't be upset and shocked when the consequences come back to you later. And a better and more common example of that would be with fast food. If you're eating fast food 5 times a week and then you wake up shocked that you have colon cancer one day, this is a direct result of a behavior that's been going on for years and years and years.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think sometimes we don't see or don't recognize how the little things we do every day add up over time.
Right.
And on the flip side, when we want to change our behavior, it's hard sometimes to see how the little things do add up in a good way. Like, for example, I used to be a smoker. I drank. I ate terribly. The only thing going for me was I was thin. But I was only thin because I had good genetics. I shouldn't have been thin. I should have wore 300 pounds. You know, ate chocolate. I mean, I just, you name it, I did it. And in the beginning, I would start to go to the gym and I'd start to eat right, but I was like, I wouldn't see any progress. And I miss smoking, and I miss you. So then I would start going doing it again. And finally, it was the day when I just woke up one day and asked myself that question in the mirror, do I want to live or do I want to die? And the answer was that I wanted to live. Did I start changing my life around?
Yeah.
And every day, it's been a little baby step. And now I'm starting to feel better than I felt in a long time. So, and again, I've had all this disease process going on and antibiotics, and I had no business smoking anyways. But the problem is when you get really sick, you get really depressed. So, like, it becomes sometimes like just a weight that's so overwhelming. I mean, at one point I was so depressed, I told my physicians, I said, obviously I need to quit smoking, but if I don't smoke, I'm going to jump off a cliff. So right now, I need to smoke. I was like, because it was true. My whole life had come crashing down. I had been treated horribly, the worst I've ever been treated in my life by the people that I was going to for help. It was just too much. It was just too much.
And I think that's the point, exactly that point, that when you are sick, you need somebody to at least acknowledge that you're sick. It's, you know, like, kiss my boo-boo, mommy, you know. Have you ever noticed when a 3-year-old comes to you with some absolutely inconsequential wound and you say, oh, that's nothing, honey, you'll be okay. Then they cry and whine and stomp their feet. But if you say, oh, honey, how awful, and you kiss it and you put a Band-Aid on it, you know, even though it's barely discolored, then they walk triumphantly off showing off their wonderful Band-Aid. So, we do sometimes just need somebody to acknowledge our pain and to know that it's real and to work with us in a constructive way to find some way out of this.
And also what you're also tapping into, too, is that sometimes also what's getting lost in the hustle and bustle of medicine is the value and the importance of physicians just looking at someone who is ill or not feeling well and saying, hey, you know, I hope you get better soon, or, you know, get some rest or, you know, something along those lines. That goes,
right, the friendly stuff.
Absolutely, it's worth its weight in gold.
It is.
To hear something kind and reassuring from somebody that you need, who you need help from. Especially because medicine is scary. It is really scary. These tests are really, I mean, you go into a big tube and all these noises and you got ear. I mean, everything about this world is really frightening to somebody who doesn't know anything about it.
Well, even if you do, it sometimes is almost more frightening to somebody who does know about it. Because it's your life on the line. I think that's what's different. It's not like your car. You know, it's going to cost you money, but it's not arms and legs. It's only money. But when it's medicine, it's your life or the life of your loved one, and that's a lot to put at risk.
Yep.
Well, Tara, thank you so much. I really appreciate you talking with me today. And good luck with the Blue Diamond Foundation. And can you tell us, is this looking for assistance for the medical advocacy projects that you're envisioning?
Yes. This is going to build upon some of the things that I've just started doing, like, you know, talking to people one-on-one, physicians, patients, and starting building on everything I've learned into actually actively making change.
Great. Well, thank you and good luck with it. And
thank you.
I appreciate talking with me.
Thank you.
And thank you for being with us today. Next week, we're going to talk with David Sandoval about a nutritional alternative for battling attention deficit disorder, or ADD. We hope you'll be with us then. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient.